Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist, here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddos' needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist. Today we're talking with Jane Singleton. She is the founder of Launchpad for Life, and she has a background in special education, which helps make her an expert in helping families foster independence, communication, and executive function skills through a coaching lens. And we're going to talk about parenting teens like a coach. So Jane, welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Wendy.
You bet. I am excited to talk about this because I have three kiddos myself, and I think it'll be helpful for folks to hear how we can better support our growing adults and growing humans that we have in our home or outside of our home, either one. But before we dive in, if you could just give us a little bit of background about what got you to this point in your career and why you do what you do.
So that I don't go too far back, but I'll kind of start with my original passion, probably for helping people with disabilities. Probably originally started when I was a camp counselor at a camp specific to people with disabilities. And I really just felt like they weren't listening to the campers and like their interests and what they wanted. And I, even as a teenager, I was like, this doesn't seem right. And I've always been interested in what makes people tick. I studied psychology and kind of did my capstone in learning more about ADHD and research around that. And then I got my master's in special education and have been building programs in independent schools for the past 13 years. So that was a combination of teaching, but really becoming not only a learning interventionist, but a behavioral interventionist. And about 6 years ago, I started my business because it was a colleague that actually asked me to help out with her young adult child, I guess you should say. And I started doing more career-based coaching that was oriented towards filling those gaps that I think we don't fill with school. School's very structured. And then it's kind of the wild, wild west as soon as you go into college, but also career. And I really acknowledged, I think, education at times, even though it's not intentional, I think chips away at the self-esteem and self-advocacy of individuals with learning disabilities. And they don't necessarily know how to transition or transfer those skills we try to teach them because a work environment is so drastically different and people are no longer coming to them. You constantly have to like initiate that task yourself. So that's my passion was filled with that. And I realized this feels so much more meaningful than helping somebody pass math class, for example. But mostly I just felt like, isn't the ultimate goal really helping people with disabilities have a successful, independent life? And I felt like there was just a need for this service. And I also pursued my certification in coaching. I'm actually a certified leadership coach as well, because I figure we can't really fix the problem if we don't also address the workplace itself. So my company's overarching big goal is really, how do we build a bridge between neurodivergent and neurotypical people and create workplaces that are neuroinclusive?
So beautiful. It is so beautiful. And then how are you guiding in terms of like, I'm sure wrapped into that is, you know, guiding parents as to what they can be doing to lay the groundwork or the foundation, and then coaching the individuals, the adults, teens themselves, so that they then are empowered, which is amazing. We need a lot of this.
Yeah. So part of my job while I was working in schools for sure was going on that journey with families from first kind of engaging in an evaluation and through the diagnostic process and then a what now. I think how I coach parents, when I get hired by a family and the teen or middle schooler or young adult still lives at home, it really is necessary for success for me to work with both the individual and the parents, because the parents are there reinforcing. That's their environment every single day. Parents are mentors. Parents are leaders. Whether you signed up for the job or not, you are growing these people in so many ways. So I really try to help parents figure out what is it about their own profiles emotionally, cognitively. We all tend to communicate in a way that works to our strengths. But when we're trying to grow an individual, we have to be reflective of when the way we want to do things, the way we want to communicate things, isn't actually working for the person we are trying to grow and trying to develop talents in, or independence in this case. And so I work a lot with parents on language that isn't working. So request language, for example, right? There's a lot of declarative statements, top-down language that doesn't really work for neurodivergent individuals in terms of there's rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is part of ADHD. There's a lot of rigid thinking for neurodivergent individuals, and sometimes the emotional defenses will come up with demands versus when it's a collaborative kind of coaching approach to problem solving. There's a lot of research out there that says agency is really, really important. And I think as parents, you're so busy. There's not enough time to actually do the collaborative planning piece. But I kind of work with parents of trying to prioritize that. It's like, find sections in your week where you're going to set aside this time to come up with a collaborative plan. Because if your child isn't engaging in problem solving, they're not building their executive functioning skills. You have to get them to get their ideas out first. And what I've seen happen over time is you might have a neurotypical parent who tends to run on the anxious side and is like, it's all just going to fall apart if I don't do it. And so it's well-intended, right? But so they jump in with a solution, and the kid then slowly becomes passive in their own life. So they don't even try to generate ideas anymore. And on one end, right, it's positively reinforcing in the sense that the child just doesn't even think about it anymore, because they're kind of like, my parents going to take care of it. I'm now a passenger in my life. Now, when you're depending the age and stage of your child, of course, there's a balance there. But ultimately, when you do this over the years, and then all of a sudden it's like you plop them in college or you plop them in their first job, and that's really overwhelming to have to all of a sudden make all of these decisions when you haven't practiced the executive functioning and planning skills of, how do I make a decision? How do I know it's the right decision? Also, what is my sense of self?
You brought up a lot of great points for families, right? And so in terms of, you know, when our babies are little, you're more of that director role. And then as they get older, we want to switch that to more of the consultant piece. But when you have an anxious parent in there, it becomes easy, like you said, for the student just to rely on that. So how are you coaching parents to think, okay, you are now a consultant, and how do you break down little pieces or chunks so that they can, a child or adult can start to prioritize and problem solve?
I think how I help parents with that is, first, they have to be aware of their own relationship in helping their child. Everything we do as humans, right, we usually engage in things because it gives us some sort of value. So what I often ask parents, like, what value do you get from helping your child or intervening? Some of it's subconscious, right? I think sometimes when we feel helpful, it does make us feel like, oh, we know what we're doing, we're smart, our opinions are valued. I mean, that there is some truth to that. The other piece is, it might be control. Control makes me feel calm. But it is the emotional relationship that the parents have to identify. And there is no bad answer. None of it makes you a bad parent. But self-awareness is required for behavior change. That is not unique if you do or don't have a learning disability. That is 100% true for everyone. And I think as adults, oftentimes, the reality is we don't have to reflect nearly as much as students do, because they're kind of constantly being evaluated. If you think about it, in school, you're constantly getting this feedback and constantly being evaluated. But as a parent, really understanding your relationship with that piece. And also, I really like to give parents the space to have authentic feelings of why do they intervene, right? Like sometimes there are feelings of resentment. Like I resent that I have to do this for my kid. I resent my child can't do this on their own. And you know what? I say, great, let's let that feeling out. Because when we don't actually verbalize those feelings, we project that into our tone, into what we do, and it ultimately damages the relationship. And honestly, it's not helping the self-esteem or the confidence of the child either. So, you know, we explore with parents is like, how can you let go and what is a goal for you? I'm never going to tell my clients, like, this is how you should do it because we all have different windows of tolerance. I'm really big with parents is what are small shifts we can make? Everybody always thinks they have to be gargantuan, right? And then when we think like that, it's so overwhelming. We're like, I'm not going to bother. I'm just not going to bother doing it. I can't. But if we think like teeny tiny shifts, like, I'm not going to put my kids' stuff by the door, I'm going to ask some questions around, hey, I know you don't like mornings, neither do I. How could we do some tasks at night that make our mornings less stressful? Because I don't like starting our day with yelling or frustration. What are your ideas?
And that's important, right? To figure out how to start with these micro steps to encourage that independence. And I like how it's like it doesn't have to be everything at once. Maybe prioritize what are our biggest things that are roadblocks right now. And starting early, I would imagine, would be the best solution or way to start with our kiddos and developing that independence is what are some little things that we can work on now to grow and develop that independence. So it's not waiting till they're 18 to figure out how, what is our schedule to get out the door independently.
Exactly. And I think it's important to remember that behavioral change for humans, right? We are talking significant behavioral change takes like a year, right? Significant, right? I'm not saying putting your bag by the door. I don't want anybody to listen to this podcast and walk away feeling depressed about it. I'm not saying putting your bag by the door. I'm saying larger behavioral shifts. So when you say, oh man, I want my kid to be better at task initiation, okay, stop initiating all their tasks. Now, some are crucial, right? Or some might directly impact your ability to get to work on time, right? Adults obviously have a variety of responsibilities. So the key is, what is the low-hanging fruit here? And I try to help maybe mediate or negotiate is like what the child is willing to do, what's their low-hanging fruit? If we made a list, what's the parents' low-hanging fruit? And like ideally, Venn diagram, there's a little bit of overlap there. That is the sweet spot to start.
What is your advice for parents that say, okay, if I don't do it, it's not going to get done, and then they're not going to end up at school or fill in the blank?
My response to that, when are you going to be comfortable with your child failing or facing natural consequences to not being prepared?
And then what are some other common mistakes that parents may make when trying to kind of coach their kids? Either through a challenge or towards independence.
I think it's number one, I would say, is sometimes parents don't always recognize what is the baseline. So, what is your child's baseline? I see a lot of parenting where it's like either way too much, right? We're doing everything, or fine, I'm just completely hands off and I'm not, you know, then we'll see how they did. And then I can tell you that they failed and they didn't learn from it. So, it is a little bit based on the child's baseline. And then I also say you have to look at capacity, right? So, capacity is both emotional and cognitive. It depends what that task is demanding of them. You know, from an academic standpoint, I always say like writing is one of the hardest tasks, but parents don't always break down something they're wanting their kids to do into multiple steps. How many steps is this behavioral change that you're wanting your child to make? How could you scaffold part of it, but not all of it? For example. So the scaffolding piece is really important because if you make a goal for your child, which I don't really want you to do, it should be a collaborative goal. because agency. I think we've all sat in enough meetings. This is not specific to children, right? Like, let's think about everyone who's ever had a job, and you sit in those meetings and, right, you talk about a new idea or new theory, and then you get a bunch of nods and smiles. I've been working in special ed, and it's one of the reasons I also do what I do now. I love empowering my clients. I love empowering families, and like changing within institutions to get people to agree is a huge deal. Just giving information to people, that's not change. And that's where I feel like the coaching piece is really missing, is like coaching is also facilitating collaborative goals, collective agreement, and reflection, because when we try new things, it doesn't work. So you have to create a shame-free environment. It didn't work. Okay, why? What about the process felt hard? And you have to be curious and ask those questions. As a coach, I have to say, I'm always surprised by my clients' answers. It's never necessarily what I thought it might be. So I guess the other piece of advice for parents is like, be careful with those assumptions. Yes, you know your kid, and we do have to give people the space to change and like the space to be curious, to really understand the why, because I think that shifts between developmental stages, right? What's important to your kid changes drastically.
Absolutely. So if we're, our focus, right, is that coaching element, what is your advice on determining the baseline, right? So you mentioned a baseline. So whether it's for the individual or for the parent, what is your advice on determining the baseline and what to work on and how to move forward?
I think you want to look across like different settings of like when, but I'll go back to the task initiation piece because I think that's a hard one. And I think that's one that many neurodivergent individuals struggle with. So obviously there's going to be a higher correlation, hopefully, with task initiation when it's high interest. What is that child's process, right? Like, when do they initiate a task? If they're at zero, then you're going to be starting a scaffolded process at zero with reminders, right? Of maybe it's a chore that you create, or, you know, you might have to start with tasks and positive reinforcements if we're at like a zero. I'm just going to call it the zero. I think if you can identify something that they, when they do initiate tasks, the other piece that's really important is like, how can you coach the child to see, hey, I really noticed like you got all your stuff together for baseball practice and you reminded me to sign the form. You reminded me that I needed to give you money for dinner. And that's really amazing. How could we transfer that skill set to X? Because the other like theme from my clients, even in adulthood, that I see is they'll share with me, I just don't understand how to transfer my knowledge from this task to another task. And so I do think as a parent, you can help coach, how are things similar? Oftentimes I find neurodivergent individuals feeling like they always have to recreate the wheel, or they're faced with like in work, they're faced with a new project that feels very different from the other one. And then they get stuck with the emotional response of like, this is new, I don't know what to do. And that's how I work with the like adults of like, well, what do you know? And like, what's the difference between self-help, self-initiation, and when is it appropriate to ask for help? Because we don't want to shame asking for help. But parents need to keep in mind too, if we always help without asking our child to like engage, what do you already know you need to do? And we constantly just answer them, we're kind of teaching them, hey, the second that you are like, I don't know what to do, you're leaning on another person. And that doesn't set them up for an independent life either. At least use some questioning to get them to engage in problem solving.
So how do parents' communication style, how does that affect a teen's emotional regulation?
Well, that's going to vary from person to person, but I think I'll share some things that I've learned from my clients. For example, if I've seen some high achieving moms who tend to lean perfectionistic, very organized, and they have a neurodivergent child, anxiety tends to make us go really fast. So does perfectionism. And if we as individuals are fast processors of information, this is how quickly we go. If I have a child who has slower processing speed, possibly some, I'm going to say, characteristics of a language disorder, because I find that very common in both people with autism and people with ADHD. It's like sometimes it's the receiving end of that. I have to adjust my language to be in chunks, to wait for the response. So, my first rule of thumb for a parent who's trying to change their behavior, I was like, are you aware, like, of these physiological symptoms of when you're not emotionally regulated, right? Or you're irritated. And if you, I said, when you know you are, that's not the time to communicate with your child, because you want to list about 100 things out and you need to categorize them so your child can actually digest like what it is that you want. So, I mean, I do encourage parents, as like anybody who's feeling very frustrated, write it all out and then pick one thing, pick the domino, pick the really big pain point. Because when we just list a whole bunch of complaints out, that's going to make anybody feel not great. I think we can say that. And then the teenager or the child or the young adult just gets a defeatist attitude, like a puppy being scolded. And they're not going to tell you how they feel. They're not going to tell you why they failed. And they do carry that with them. I have yet to meet a client who truly does not care what their parents think.
I like how you said that to pick one. I always say that prioritizing and so forth, just even with IEPs or things that parents are working on in the educational ring, I think it's important because then you're not overwhelmed or watering elements down. You pointed out cognitive capacity and with that, the emotional capacity as well. How do we coach our kids through that in terms of reacting or calming or problem solving that comes along with big emotions?
I think modeling can be powerful. Sharing, like, I think sometimes parents fear of, like, I don't want to burden my child with, like, when I have a bad day. I totally understand that, like, there's levels and, like, certain details you might leave out. But I think it's important that we show our children that we have a wide variety of emotions. And children are some of the most empathetic people when you're real with them and you're authentic. I experienced this at teaching. I always would model, I really had a horrible morning, right? I was late. I said, I'm feeling a little bit frazzled. I would really appreciate if you guys could be patient with me and like show me some love, and I'm gonna do my best. And they usually were the best behaved, ironically. So I think modeling that, and sometimes saying, you know, I do this, like, what has calmed you in the past? Get them to kind of reflect. And if they don't have a routine, I always say play with it, right? Try something out, and then you can tell me it didn't work.
So, what's some best ways to approach goal, say goal setting, if you have a teen that's resistant?
I think, well, goal setting, I think it depends. Is your teenagers can be more in the moment. So there's like short-term and long-term goals. My first question would be, as you know your child, like, which one are they more motivated by? I actually think incorporating long-term goals, like what are you interested in career-wise, and tying it to the here and now can be important to motivation, because kids will get stuck in algebra. Well, I'm never going to use algebra again, so who cares if I pass this test? But sometimes, again, you can't see past like how this might impact you. I think if you can build connections with goals, I think that's really important. And sometimes I'll have clients, I think, that have a harder time like creating goals. It's because I will say they're not unhappy, they're not uncomfortable. And sometimes that's because their parents are actually doing everything. So I'm going to give this example because it's important, but if I'm not particularly social, right? Let's say I'm not. Let's say I'm actually kind of afraid of like living in an apartment on my own or going off to college. And at home, my mom or dad brings me soup. I never have to cook. I don't have chores. I don't do cleaning. I do nothing that resembles what adult life responsibilities are. That's actually cushy. I mean, if we step out of ourselves, right? I love that I live on my own, but my point is, if we step out of ourselves, I'm sure as adults we have moments I'm like, man, do I wish I had it so good as this teenager? And so sometimes the back door to goal setting is just exposure. And I will still say this, I think if your child, teenagers especially, they will learn so much from having a job, whatever the job is. They are much more motivated by peers, what society thinks of them, agency, feeling like they're contributing to something. I think financial independent, like having your own money, great. But if you're just constantly giving your kid all the money and all the things, and like, I wouldn't really have a goal because I don't need to earn money to like buy that dress that I've really been wanting. So I will say sometimes it's because you're making it too easy. Outside of sensory issues, again, I'm not going to be able to cover every detailed like individual at this juncture. I obviously go through the characteristics of their neurodivergent profile and consider, okay, is this a sensory issue? Like there's alternative behaviors and cases can become more complicated, but.
So, how can parents help teach resilience then without overwhelming their teen?
I think resilience is taught through how do you coach them through the hardship at hand? That could easily be like a friendship issue. There's a lot of stuff around social media, right? Posting. I think it all really comes back to values. I think really thinking about if you have not defined as parents, like what are your family values? Then I would start there, going back to baseline. I'd start there. And maybe you feel like, hey, we as parents both really agree on our values, but how are we intentionally talking about and teaching these values? And do our boundaries with our children match those values? Because at the end of the day, resilience has to do with liking yourself and when you feel like you're showing up in the world in the way that you want to show up. And that's what makes you resilient when things don't go your way.
Can you give us some examples of that in terms of coming to the baseline, defining values, and then teaching your kid that element?
So I'll give a situation. Let's say your young adult, anywhere between teenager and college, whatever, lives with you and leaves their dishes in the sink, doesn't ever initiate helping out in the household in any way, shape, or form, crumbles when you complain about it or argues, right? There's either anger or sadness, I think, right? These two extremes versus actually talking through those things. When we walk through the day like that and they don't face like a natural consequence, so maybe that is no electronics, or maybe that is not going to the sleepover or access to the car. Again, you have to remember, I'm just going to say this, most of these people in this case, as appropriate, are freeloaders, right? Like it is a little bit of a bartering system until they're dependent because that's how they earn things. I think it's parent, do you, if your value is, I want my kid to be self-sufficient, but you clean up their dishes out of the sink, you feel bad because they cried or got angry with you and you said, I just don't want to deal with this. Like, I'm not even going to bother telling him to do this again because then he's going to get angry or he's going to cry and shut himself in his room. Then we stay in this cycle. So that's the cycle we stay in. And that still brings me back to values and parent behavioral changes. Like, what do they have to do? I mean, saving the dishes in the sink or whatever is within your window of tolerance. But if we just keep fixing it, we're no longer giving feedback. And I can tell you, every client I've worked with was like, I just know they're gonna do it. And that's the cold, hard truth. And we start to, I do think unintentionally, we parents can start to almost treat their kid like they're incompetent and they're resentful because they're not holding their child to a standard. And the growth is always going to be painful. Like the growth piece is painful. So I think having the expectation as a parent that it's not going to be easy and you're going to have to suffer a little bit as you try to engage your child in changing their behavior. That is a given most of the time. Sometimes you get out of it.
Yeah, right. Because when you are trying to change that behavior, the kiddo is going to spike their reaction to mm-hmm. see kind of what that threshold is before they're like, oh, okay, wait, I can change my behavior, right? The response is going to be bigger, typically, whether that's crying or anger, whatever that can look like. And then it's kind of just, all right, how are you managing that as a parent? How do you feel about that and knowing that it's going to be okay, but the kid's response is going to get bigger because they're just used to it happening. And now you're saying we're changing. So really kind of thinking that through as well and guiding parents that the response is going to get bigger, but then it will be okay.
Mm-hmm. And what motivates your kids? So sometimes, right, some kids, it is going back to that baseline piece is like, how bad has it gotten? So if we've really dug ourselves like a hole, you have to remember you did contribute to the fact that almost like your child system can't emotionally handle you holding them to this new standard, right? Because you are shifting your boundaries. So you have to own the fact that you might have contributed to this cycle. What is the baseline? Do we have to pair the request with some sort of attached positive reinforcement that we slowly take away once they get into a routine? Because motivation can be really difficult, especially for neurodivergent individuals.
Yeah. And again, just kind of highlighting, picking that, as you said, domino, right? So you're picking one item first. So we're not changing and rocking the whole system, but let's kind of chip away a little bit at a time. And talking about kind of that traditional parenting role, how is coaching different from that? And then why is that effective?
I think the coaching role involves a lot more questions versus statements. And I think the traditional parenting role tends to be more declarative statements or demands or rules or boundaries. So the coaching piece is more about questioning, reflecting, being curious, and being neutral. I'm just going to go ahead and say that being neutral is key here of how can you not react to the outcome? Because the outcome's not the problem. I always say the outcome's the autopsy, right? Like it's dead already. Like it's DOA. So the only thing we have to learn from here is the process, because that goes back to the small shift thinking. What's the small shift? Right? I woke up late every single morning and therefore that's why I forgot my stuff all week. Right? As a parent, right? Where are your boundaries? I'll forgive you once, but I'm not going to leave work twice to bring you your baseball stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it stinks, but it's kind of separating yourself from, you are not in charge of your child's life. Like at some juncture, you are 100%. Every parent I work with is like the most devoted, biggest cheerleader, all the things. And you physically cannot puppeteer them. Their life is not yours. And so all the lessons we've all learned along the way that caused us to shift behavior. And sometimes I'll be honest with my clients, it is, they lost a job. They failed out of college, right? Or the parents have gotten to such a deep cycle, right? Sometimes it's a hygiene issue, right? It can be all levels of that. So picking that domino and really building on it and having the belief that ultimately your child can do it. Because the other language piece that I see parents get into is they've watched their child have such like a lower emotional capacity that, you know, I might have like a 17-year-old who physically is fine, just so we're clear. So we all know 17-year-olds have way more energy than 40-year-olds. I think we can all agree on that, right? So this idea that like, oh, I've heard parents say, respond before, there, zero pushback from the individual kid, but parents being like, oh, that'd be a really, I think 5:30, that's like too light. It'd be a really long day for him. Stating that in advance, in front of your child, like think about what that really communicates. I've also had parents say, there's no way they can work virtually. I just don't think they're going to be able to do it. And I'm like, let's explore. Like, let's give them that opportunity to see what they can do before we decide that for them. Because the truth is I think it is hard to raise a neurodivergent child, especially if you're a neurotypical, it's like harder to relate. And we can have like, we've developed as parents, right? These layers of almost like PTSD, right? I use that very lightly, but like, it's a relatable term of like, you just kind of start assuming the worst. And so going back to why I often work with parents too, is you kind of have to chip away at that and rebuild the mindset of like, what if, right? And good coaching, if you're going to coach your kid, is like, maybe your kid is like tied to a dream that you're like, this is never going to happen, right? I mean, realistic goals are hard, especially at certain developmental stages. But okay, like, what do you think goes into that? Or like, what percentage of people do this? You know, what would you have to do to prepare for this instead of kind of shooting the idea down? It's just working with them, I think, in a different way.
What practical ways can parents model, going back to kind of that emotional regulation and response during conflict? What can parents do to model that? Because we all lead as a parent with that fear and love in our heart. And kind of what you're saying, you know, you parents may have this thought in their head. And so that may get shifted by a teen's response. So then how can we model that emotional regulation when things are hectic or conflict or both?
Name it. Name the feeling. Name what's going on. Name it. You are the, I'm just going to say this, you are the adult in the relationship, right? Like, you're the leader, even if your child is an adult, right? I think we'll all probably, at my age, I would argue that 18 really is like the same version of an adult as like a 30-year-old. I mean, we know that's not true. Name it, right? Because you are the leader, just like in a corporation, right? Are you going to go head to head with somebody that's like dysregulated? Or are you going to say this, right? We get taught about this professionally. This conversation's feeling really unproductive. I kind of want to reconvene when we each have a chance to calm down. Would later tonight or tomorrow be better for you? Immediately giving options to your child. Don't say, I'm going to do this tomorrow. Because again, power move. And I'm telling you, with more and more, I'm seeing this diagnosis of personality demand avoidance. And I struggle with that one a little bit, because I actually think it's a symptom of like cycles oftentimes. And this is probably, it's professional, but it's personal, right? Of just working with these groups of individuals for so long of like, I think it's a demand for agency that we haven't been giving for years. Like, they feel like they don't have agency. They feel like they don't have sense of self. They feel like they don't have control. In some cases, and more, I think, right, if you're more severe cases, depending what the characteristics of your diagnosis are, is it's really hard to feel out of control of your like mind and body in that way. And they want some power. So don't take simple, so small shifts, simple, give them simple powers. What would you rather do? Would you rather reconvene tonight, or should we just wait and talk about a time tomorrow?
Yeah,
give call, small power. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is awesome, because we call that power of assuming the sale, right? We know we're going to meet. We know this is happening. We feel dysregulated. This is conversations happening. Do you want to? So I'm assuming that, yes, this is going to happen. I need this to happen, even with like bedtime, right? I know you need to go to bed. So I'm going to assume the sale that you're going to go to bed. Then we give the power of choice. Do you want to go to bed now, or do you want to go to bed in 10 minutes? Do you want to meet tonight, or do you want to meet tomorrow morning? Because then, like, all of this conversation leads to that, like you said, the agency and the autonomy that as humans, we all want, right? You want a power of choice. You want to say, you want to feel like you have some sort of control in a situation. And so as the adult, regardless of if it's a teenager or young adult, wherever that age range is, using that power of choice, I think, is huge.
And I think the small language shifts too, of even though I think parents get really caught up in like, you're not listening to me. It's a cycle. You're not listening to me. And I watched, right, like, get out of the bed. Like, come talk to me. Come in the living room and talk to me, right? Instead of, again, demand, try, hey, if you're up for it, would you like to come to the living room? This is very important for people that have PDA, is like regular connection, no demand, and then saying, I've done this with my clients, right, that are not sitting at the computer with me, kind of connect about the day and say, hey, if you're up for it, do you want to come join me by the computer? And they come. But do you see how different that feels? It's still an option, and it's still agency. And that's why Emotion. That's what I'm saying. The parent piece, coaching on being emotionally regulated and aware of your emotions as a parent, is essential to being able to do those small shifts.
So then how can parents guide that rebellious behavior that some teens have while maintaining a strong connection with their kiddo?
Allow your child to experience natural consequences. I think that's important. Going back to, you absolutely cannot control your child, right? You're not going to be glued to them all day. They are going to make poor choices, whether influenced by peers, whether they initiate the idea, and a consequence will come. And how can you be a soft landing spot? They know, like, right? They get in trouble. How do we handle that when that consequence comes? Tell me about it. Leave it simple. Leave it open. To me, it really goes back to that autopsy piece, is like, if you dwell on that outcome, they already know they screwed up. Like, they do. And so if you want to be that soft landing spot, and when you are the soft landing spot, your child is actually more likely to share with you. No one is going to share with you when you're constantly berating them. That doesn't mean you can't deliver consequences, right? Like, you can. I also think, the dynamic wise, it is important as a parent, like, to say, you know, when you got in trouble at school, I left a really important meeting and I'm really stressed out that I'm not going to get a promotion now. And it is what it is. But I was like, but I need you to understand, like, connections from your behavior and to how that impacts other people in the family, because they are not making those natural connections. Say the things you don't think need to be said. That is the equivalent of explicit instruction. And in parenting, it's just explicitly making connections. And you're all the more healthier for saying it out loud. This is how it impacted my day. I want to find a solution so we don't have to be here again.
Yeah, and do it while you're young, right? So mistakes give you that opportunity to learn and grow. And while you're young, it's easier to course correct when the consequences aren't as grave as they are when you're a young adult or an adult. So then, how can empathy help parents kind of resolve these conflicts?
I think empathy helps create the safe space in and of itself, right? If we're not communicating, you're not getting any information as a parent. I guarantee you don't know what the problem is. You don't know what the problem in the process is. There is not going to be any engagement in reflection. I think you have to ask yourself as a parent, what is the worst case scenario for me? Like, if I am so desperate to help, what am I doing that's helping me get the information I need? And what am I doing that's a barrier to getting the information I need? Because you can't control another person. You can only control how you're approaching the situation. And I think parents probably have enough evidence, if they, like, sat with that, of like, man, when my child, I can't stand it when my child doesn't communicate with me. Okay, great. When is your child shut down the most? What are the patterns between the two of you? When have you been successful? Why? What was different?
There's a lot of self-reflection, I think, that needs to take place, right? With the coaching model, so that we can then successfully be a coach to our kiddos.
Exactly.
Whew. All right. So, kind of as we're winding down, what is a question that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked?
Oh, let's see. That's an excellent question. Maybe how can I collaborate with schools on themes and goals that I'm seeing at home? Like, how can I, like, contribute what I'm seeing so that they can identify those on the IEP? So when you go to the IEP meeting, instead of constantly thinking about IEPs as school specific, like, again, task initiation, is how can you be collaborative about some of the things that you're finding and repeating, and or use some of the stuff from the school to mirror where they're having success. And I think, and partner, because, right, behavior change, you can lean into either environment about what's working. You don't have the leverage of peers, which are really important to teenagers and preteens. But you can, I think, how can you share information across settings to kind of improve understanding your child's baseline? Getting pieces of information where you can give your kid praise or acknowledge where they actually are engaging in a particular task, and things along those lines.
And to piggyback on that, I think it's really important. I'm glad you brought up the IEP component. As you know, it's a little bit of a passion of mine, the IEP, but that parent input statement, right? So kind of pulling this all together. So talking, thinking through as a parent, where do you and your kid, when your kiddo, at when they're ready to have that conversation and that goal setting to say, all right, where do you see in 6 months, a year, 2 years, and 5 years, so that we can start that language in the IEP to really bridge that home and school, because oftentimes they act as silos. And I'm glad you brought up that point, Jane, because then you're thinking, all right, this is what I'm seeing at home. This is what we're seeing at school. How do we bridge that gap? And then start to layer in pieces through whether it's goals or accommodations or services in terms of supporting that coaching aspect towards independence, right? And so having that kind of forward thinking and that reflection of what can we do to support this kiddo between home and community. I always want to add the community component in there and school. So you have these three areas so that whatever you're coaching towards independence is hopefully being then independently employed by the kiddo themselves eventually. And that's kind of our goal, so that they're not necessarily living in our basement. And I guess, which is not a bad thing, but if you have a kiddo that can be independent, or whatever independence looks like, I always ask parents, what does independence look like to you? Does have your kiddo be independent? What does that look like? And that can be different for different kids in terms of where they're heading, their capacity, both cognitive and, like you said, emotional. And so just really kind of thinking through all of that and then prioritizing.
Yeah. And don't forget to ask your kid, what does independence look like to you? I can tell you on all this agency, like what that might be a great backdoor to goal setting.
Yeah.
You want to make your own decisions. I see it. You're fighting me. That's great. Like, what does your ideal agency might not be a familiar word for teens, but like, what does independence look like to you? Like in your ideal world, how much power would you have that you think would make you happier? Ask those questions. I think we're not asking those questions, and that's part of the problem, honestly.
Yeah, totally. And I think you may be surprised, or it may be seem scary as a parent to ask, but then now you're going to know, right? Like how much, you know, what does that look like? What does that feel like? And even, you know, if you talk to your kid, how was this? Good. Well, what does good look like? What does that mean? And asking those questions, whether it, if they'll talk to you by sitting on the couch, if you need to get in the car and go for a drive, whatever that may be, but just to start opening up that conversation. And then as a parent, start thinking through, okay, how can we make those micro shifts? So much to think about. If you had a billboard for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
Flexibly plan.
And what does that mean?
I think it means a lot of the emotional stress that I see in parents comes from parents being tied to an outcome for their child. And if we can have hopes for our kid, but when we actually get too tied to an outcome, we become rigid in our thinking and then we can't problem solve. And life is all about pivoting. And there's a lot of pivoting when you have a neurodivergent child. There just is.
Yes. No 2 days are the same. And all kids are different. Like I have three and they're all so different. They're not even on the same. Somebody said, oh, they're probably in different chapters of the book. I'm like, they're not even on the same shelf in the library. Forget about chapters in the same book. They're all three on different corners of the library. So, you know, and just juggling, right? And then just trying to figure out life. So I think this is a really timely conversation to have, and hopefully parents and even professionals are listening, because I think there's a lot of nuggets of information that you shared that professionals can start to weave into what they're doing to help guide and bridge and communicate and collaborate with that home team, that community team, that school team as a whole to support a student as they're trying to get their bearings for their own independence. This was amazing. I really appreciate your time chit-chatting with us today, and I will put all of your information in the show notes so folks can reach out to you and find you. So I appreciate you coming out and chatting today.
All right. Thanks, Wendy.
You bet. Thanks. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.